Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 14th, 2015, and please let the record show that we do have a quorum. Members, we have four bills on the agenda today dealing with agriculture. We're going to begin with Senate File 949, Senator Reinhart. Senator Reinhart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my seventh year in the legislature. I've never, ever been before your committee. I have so many tillable acres in the city of Duluth that I'm shocked. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill. And Mr. Chair and members, I've got two testifiers with me, and I think what if you're okay with it, Mr. Chair, I'll let them talk a little bit, and then I can answer questions specifically about the bill. So, Mr. Chair, to my right is Carla Powers. She's the director of the Duluth Public Library. And then to my left is Russ Henry. And Ms. Powers will talk a little bit about where this whole bill came from. This is a classic, like many of us have. Something happened in our district, and we try to find the solution for it. And then Russ, I think, will talk about maybe some of the wider implications for folks that he has worked with as well. So, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll invite Ms. Powers to go first.
Ms. Henry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Sparks, members of the committee. In 2015, the Duluth Public Library is celebrating its 125th year of helping the community become more knowledgeable, pursue their creative interests, and pool their resources to share items of importance to Duluth's citizens. The specific items we have shared over the years have varied. It started with printed books, of course, and later expanded to include everything from magazines to music and movies in various formats to educational toys for children. Last year, the Duluth Public Library's offerings expanded further to include four varieties of open-pollinated non-hybrid vegetable seeds. The Duluth Seed Library formed as a partnership with public library staff, the Duluth Community Garden Program, the St. Louis County Master Gardeners, and a local nonprofit called the Institute for a Sustainable Future. The Seed Library opened 1 year ago to overwhelming community enthusiasm and support. With help from a grant from the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships Program, we purchased pepper, tomato, pea, and bean seeds, as well as pepper and tomato transplants for the 2014 gardening season. About 200 community members signed up to join the Seed Library. The idea behind a seed library is that members borrow a small packet of seeds, plant them in their yard or community garden plot, and at harvest time save a portion of the seed from their plants to return back to the seed library for another gardener's use the following year. By providing people with seeds free of charge, the seed library aims to promote gardening, encourage people to consume fresh produce that they have grown themselves, and strengthen community ties through seed exchange. Ideally, by saving seeds from their best plants over many growing seasons, Seed Library members will help develop a locally adapted seed stock that is well suited for Duluth's growing conditions. A big part of the Seed Library's mission, in addition to making gardening more accessible by providing free seeds, is to help educate the community about gardening and seed saving. We used a portion of the U of M grant to enhance our collection of gardening and seed saving books and to bring in experts for educational programs. We were surprised when the Minnesota Department of Agriculture informed us that the Seed Library is not in compliance under state law. Just to be clear, I understand that MDA was following through on their responsibility to enforce the law, and I appreciate that throughout this whole process they have approached it in a spirit of cooperation and not confrontation. By the same token, I understand that the state seed law provides appropriate and necessary protections for farmers who operate large-scale farms and need to be absolutely confident in the purity and the quality of the seed that they buy. However, the requirements for permitting, labeling, and especially germination testing are difficult and, I believe, unnecessary for small-scale community-based seed libraries. The gardeners in Duluth and elsewhere who exchange seeds with their neighbors are willing to accept the risk that the handful of seeds they receive may not germinate or be true to type. It's part of the learning experience. Quoting from the Duluth Seed Library's values statement, "Public libraries play a vital role in communities as a repository for a diversity of ideas and shared knowledge for the public good. Similarly, seed is a public resource and shared legacy. It must be managed in a manner that benefits the public good. People have saved, selected, and improved seed for thousands upon thousands of years. Seed is the repository for crop diversity, the foundation of agriculture, and by its nature provides the foundation for healthy and resilient communities." On behalf of the Duluth Seed Library and seed libraries elsewhere in Minnesota, I would like to thank Senator Reinert and others who have authored this bill, and I would urge you to support Senate File 949. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Powers. Thank you for explaining the problem, and Senator Reinert for your hard work on it. Any questions for the witness members at this time? If not, Mr. Henry, if you'd like to address the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Sparks, and thank you, committee members. I'm Russ Henry, and I'm the co-chair of the Homegrown Minneapolis Food Council. Homegrown Minneapolis is a citywide initiative expanding the community's ability to grow, process, eat, distribute, and compost healthy, sustainable, locally grown foods. As the co-chair of Homegrown, I am persuaded that seeds are one of the fundamental building blocks of many life-giving systems, including ecological systems, food systems, economies, and human culture. From seeds sprout food, medicine, beauty, wealth, and health. Open access to seed sharing on a communal and interpersonal level is essential in a free and just culture, and is a tradition that spans thousands of years. Now in Minnesota, we have the chance to make history by passing this first-of-its-kind legislation to change the Minnesota seed law and permanently protect community-based, non-commercial seed sharing. As a result of the advocacy by organizations across the state of Minnesota, from Duluth to St. Paul to Minneapolis, as well as a nationwide petition that garnered more than 7,000 signatures, we are grateful to welcome this legislation, introduced by Senator Reinert, to exempt interpersonal seed sharing and seed libraries from the overburdensome requirements in the Minnesota seed law. Growing the local food system by helping to protect seed libraries and interpersonal seed sharing across the state of Minnesota could demonstrate Minnesota's commitment to food access and serve as model legislation for other states interested in securing and protection for these activities. Thank you, Senators, for considering this important legislation. I urge you to vote yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Henry. Any questions at this time for committee members?
Mr. Chair, Reiner, if now would be an appropriate time, members, just to make a couple of comments about the bill. So the bill does two pretty straightforward things. I think, members, you heard sort of what the situation is. If you, as a individual, planted a garden and you ever walked over to your neighbor and said, these seeds worked really great for me last year here, why don't you try a couple in your garden this year? Technically, you were in violation of state law. I think Carla, Ms. Powers, correctly indicated that, you know, the Department of Ag was doing its job when it noted that what the Duluth Library was doing with its seed library was technically in violation. You know, we as a legislature give them sort of marching orders, and they were following those orders, though they acknowledged that it probably the situation at the seed with the Duluth Library was probably not what the legislature intended when it originally passed the law. Members, it was really more for large commercial farmers in our state who invest thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in their seed stock, needing to know that that seed stock was viable and would produce a cash crop for them. So in partnership with the interested parties, and I do want to especially credit the Department of Ag, who was very active in trying to figure out what the right solution was for this. In fact, the department convened a meeting of all interested parties. We probably had 20-plus people around the table trying to figure out the right way forward. We came up with the bill that is before you, and members, it does two things. Now, in the first section, it strikes giveaway. Up until this point, any giving away of a seed for planting purposes was illegal, or I guess right now is illegal in the state of Minnesota. So again, if you were sharing with your neighbor, you're violating state law. It does a second thing, and that is it includes a cap of $5,000. The department, and I think commercial seed producers, want to know that there is a regulatory hook. And so over $5,000 does not allow a company to give a farmer tens of thousands of dollars worth of seed and say, hey, I'm not selling you seed, therefore I don't have to comply with any of the regulations in the state of Minnesota. You know, I'll hit you, farmer, somewhere else with the other products that go along with that. And that was important to the department so that they still have that regulatory hook in the legislation. And then thirdly, it just in Section 2, Paragraph B, outlines the type of organizations, religious, charitable, scientific, literary, educational, or individuals that are intended to be permitted to share seeds with each other and therefore not have to do the germination tests and the labeling requirements that otherwise commercial seed producers have. So, Mr. Chair, that's the bill. It's pretty straightforward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about where this came from, what the process has been, or how we got here today.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Reinhart. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Reinhart. I understand a lot of this is for seed sharing.
Correct.
So why do we have grocery seeds? If we're selling seeds, where's the sales of these seeds coming in at if it's mostly sharing?
Sure. Senator Mr. Reinhart? Chair, Senator Dames, the language there in paragraph B is modeled after something that the department, and maybe others, I don't know, it was new to me, called the pickle law. This was intended to cover people that were at county fairs and farmers markets that were pickling items at home, beets, pickles, things like that, and selling them. Without an exemption, they were subject to all of the same regulations that a Gedney pickle was, a large commercial food producer. And so the pickle law gave some exception for people under a small gross sales amount to not have to meet that higher standard that a large commercial producer would have to meet. So that language is modeled on language that we already have in state law.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, Senator Reinhart here, it's very specific to the sale of seeds. Do you know, are any of these groups selling seeds? Is this a must to be in this bill?
Senator Reinhart.
Mr. Chair, and I'll invite either testifier. I'm not aware that sales are taking place. We're just trying to anticipate that some people might, cash might exchange hands. And, you know, we have this situation where they're in violation of state law because they gave a seed away. So based on that pickle exemption, you know, tried to anticipate what might happen in the future so we wouldn't have to be back here revisiting this. But, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll invite either testifier to comment on whether they're aware that any sales are taking place.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I am, and Senator Dames, I am not aware of any sales being taken place at any of the seed libraries in any way, shape, or form. I believe that the $5,000 cap was intended, as Senator Reinhart said, to make sure that we could still have some small sales. I believe the requirements right now for testing of seeds would probably come in around a $500 or $1,000 range. And so if you're going to have to test seeds, I think folks would want to be making more money back than $5,000 per year on seed sales. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Thank you.
We do have a couple people that like to testify on the bill, but thank you very much, Senator Reinhart, if you want to stay there, and thank you, Ms. Powers and Mr. Henry, for your testimony. So at this point, I have a Mr. Lang. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ben Lang. I'm president and CEO of the Minnesota Crop Improvement Association. Minnesota Crop Improvement Association, or MCIA, was founded back in 1903 to promote the breeding, growing, and distribution of improved crop varieties. In 1955, MCIA was officially recognized under the Minnesota Seed Law as the official seed certifying agency. As an independent third party, MCI provides certification and quality assurance to its over 500 members, including producers and handlers of field crop seed of all kinds grown in Minnesota, turf seed, forage seed, native plant seed, as well as other agricultural products. The seed law is of particular interest to our organization because MCI and its membership considers a strong seed regulatory program to be the foundation for transparency and accountability in the marketing of seed. Since its adoption, the Minnesota seed law has played an essential role in the improvement of seed quality to the benefit of agricultural producers and other seed consumers. MCIA cannot support or endorse changes to the law that will weaken its ability to achieve its purpose of requiring responsible behavior and accountability from all who choose to distribute seed. Seed regulations require, at their core, those choosing to distribute seed to identify who they are and provide a label that accurately represents the seed they are offering. And this is important for a number of reasons already mentioned, including varietal identity, freedom from weed seed, including noxious weeds, viability, intellectual property issues related to seed, safety issues related to seed treatments, and most of all, I would argue, accountability. Labeling is a declaration to which regulators can hold seed providers accountable. For that reason, and for those reasons, MCIA's position on granting seed exemptions is as follows. MCIA supports a strong seed law in Minnesota. Those that distribute seed should provide labels that accurately represent their seed to consumers. MCI is concerned that granting exemptions from the labeling requirements creates opportunity to undermine the protections offered under the seed law in ways that are difficult to anticipate and impossible to regulate. Any changes to the seed law to allow variances should consider the reason for the variance, quantities of seed being distributed, whether financial compensation will be involved, distance of seed movement, kinds, varieties, and uses of the seeds, and most importantly, the potential for negative impacts on seed users. We would like to see MDA develop guidelines to address situations where a variance might be necessary, such as instances where there is an insufficient quantity of seed to permit proper testing. Labels for seed distributed without complete labeling information should include a notice to the consumer. And that's our position on it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lang, for your testimony. And I also have any questions for the witness members? Thank you. Ms. Brunel, are you here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jessie Brunel. I am with the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. MCPR is a 60-year-old trade association representing the crop input professionals who supply Minnesota's farmers with fertilizer, pesticide, seed, and agronomy services such as crop advising and precision agriculture. I'm also the executive director of the Minnesota Certified Crop Advisors. Currently, there are 345 MCPR members and 640 CCAs in Minnesota. To respect your time, Mr. Chair, I will refer to a handout that has a position on our bill. Give it to one of the staff. Okay. And in summary, we would support the Minnesota.
Chief Author, could I get a copy of your handout?
In summary, we would support the Minnesota Crop Improvement Association as the seed certifying organization in Minnesota and believe that all Minnesotans deserve the protection of preserving the system, which ensures the quality and accurate description of the seed they are receiving. We plan to work with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the author to address the needs of our public libraries and also preserving our seed regulatory system.
Thank you, Ms. Brunel. Thank you for your testimony, and we'll make sure that members get a handout. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Reinert, I apologize. I was late getting here with some other meetings I had. But a question for you, and you maybe covered this before I got here, but in regards to these seed library in regards to the sales of 5,000 or less. Are we primarily talking about, and I think about, for example, I do some gardening, and I think about if the seed catalogs promote some seed money-raising opportunities for your charitable organizations. Then also, I know that there's a lot of interest in what we call more of the heritage variety seeds and that type of thing. Is this intended more for the vegetable market than it is for seed corn, seed wheat, et cetera?
Senator Reiner?
Mr. Chair and Senator, exactly so. Particularly the second part of what you said, you know, a desire to keep some heirloom seeds alive and keep those strains around. And Mr. Chair, if I could just note to both testifiers, neither has contacted me up until this point, and this bill was introduced the first week of session. I would love to have had those conversations before the table. And I would note that the MDA is supportive of this bill and feels that they still retain all the regulatory power they need on the commercial side, which I think most of us recognize is really what the statute is meant to address.
Senator Weber.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I mean, as we deal with that portion about at least those lines that deal with less than $5,000 gross receipts, would it be helpful to the parties involved if it's specifically said vegetable as opposed to an open-ended seed designation there?
So, Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a great question, and I look at this committee and see farmers, so I'm welcome to input on that, and I think the chair's intention is to lay the bill over, so okay. There's opportunity to work with the chairman to find that okay. language. And Mr. Chair, I'd also just mention to Senator Dame's earlier question, there's nothing magic about the 5,000 number. That was just meant to set the floor at which over the department had all of its regulatory authority for commercial seed.
Yeah, and Senator Reiner, and I apologize, member. Our intention is to delay this bill over today, and we'll continue to work on it. I believe that Senator Reiner has tried to narrow it down to address the issues at the Duluth Library, and I know that the Department of Ag has been very involved, too. But our hope would be that we'll lay it on the table for possible inclusion in our ag policy bill. But having said that, we can still have further discussion. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Reinhart, would you be friendly to an oral amendment to remove line on page 1, remove line 121 through 123. That if that's removed, it still allows the libraries and stuff to do the things they want to do. It's just that we don't have the sales of seed up to $5,000. And, I think the libraries can still do everything they want to do. And would you accept that as a friendly oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, I would ask the department to come to the table. They were the ones to suggest to me that is similar to this pickle bill exemption.
Mr. Cruz, welcome to the committee. Welcome to back to the committee.
That's right. Good afternoon, Chair Santa Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, the pickle law history is correct. We can look at the amount. One of the things that we don't want to get into is reopening our seed law. As you can tell, there's a lot of interest embedded in Minnesota's history in agriculture in the seed law. And this has certainly raised the public awareness around some of the areas that the department would like to accommodate. I should say that the department, through the governor's process, will have its own language and its own bill forthcoming. I'm aware that it's been delivered but not yet introduced to the Senate. It's very similar to what you're seeing here today. So we see this as well as not just 121 through 123, but any number of areas may need to be tweaked. Senator Reiner has been a fantastic partner to work with, as have, quite frankly, you haven't heard from anybody today that I have not personally met with and talked to about this law. With the exception, I should say, of MCIA, I met with Bill Bond. But at any rate, what I would suggest, because this is going to be laid over, we can then see what the department's language has and work on the bill to address anybody's concerns. But to be honest with you, I think that the quote-unquote cliche of peace in the valley is very close on this particular law.
And Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, if I could just add, having a moment to think that through, that would make me uncomfortable and I think would make the department uncomfortable because it just leaves us with striking give away, and that leaves the door open for bad actors to circumvent the statute completely. So the two sort of worked in tandem, that we don't make giving away illegal, but we also narrowly prescribe who can and up to what amount.
Sir Dave.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, you say this bill will be laid over. I would appreciate, once there's some peace in the valley, this bill comes back for further discussion here before we just put it in the omnibus policy bill.
Definitely. That's, so that is my intention,
I think we need to get some peace in the valley and see where this is going to go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you, Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Santo,
the Department of Ag, and Senator Reinert for your hard work.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll continue to work on this. Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 949 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus ag policy bill. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Reinert. Next is Senator Jensen in the room?
She's here.
Senator Jensen, we have Senate File 961. Oh, Senator Eakin, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just before they step forward with this bill, I just wanted to recognize and welcome members from the Minnesota Wheat Growers Association and also the Northwest Farm Bureau are here today. So welcome to the committee.
Great. Welcome. Senator Jensen, Senate File 961. Welcome back to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm here with Senate File 961, which will establish an agricultural educator grant program. And the intention is that we provide some money for within the high schools. I do have an amendment if someone would be willing to offer that for me.
Members, we have the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would prefer. This is her first stop. So Senator Schmidt moves that A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Jensen, to your
Thank bill. You, Mr. Chair. With the adoption of that amendment, we have corrected what is on line 1.8, extension programs, which was just a typo, to put it into extended projects within the high schools. And that's what this bill is meant to do. And on line 1.15, we're providing each teacher the one-half share of 40 working days. And I have someone here that can talk about this. But the idea is that the ag programs within our schools was meant to have an experiential learning aspect to it. And in particular, in order to do that, most of the things that we do as far as agriculture, there are a lot of things we can do in the classroom, but there are a lot of things that take place outside in weather that we're able to do them. And what has happened is a lot of the summer extended month programs have been cut, and that opportunity for those students has been removed from their from that experiential learning experience. We want to get that back in the schools, and we want to provide that opportunity for those students to have that part, because we know that experiential learning provides something that you can't get just from reading it in a book, and kids do learn well. I do have someone with me that is kind of an expert in this area. Jerry Schoenfeld, if you want to go ahead and...
Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators. And I guess I don't oftentimes think of myself as that much of an expert, so I appreciate that. One of the first things that I'd like to relate to you is, I think you have a handout in your files there that shows Minnesota Ag, Food, and Natural Resources Education. Am I right?
Yep.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to point out there is the circle on the the circle model on the bottom of the page. And what you'll find is that agricultural education is a bit unique, I think, in the sense that there are three components to agricultural education. One is the academics in the classroom. For most of you that have noticed or been from rural areas and seen the blue jackets that oftentimes invade our capital, the second component is the leadership component, which is in the FFA, which is an intracurricular, not an extracurricular activity. And it's part of the learning process. And third is the experiential learning, a portion of it which is known as SAE, the Supervised Ag Experience Program. Now, if you go back historically, a couple of things that I thought have been interesting as I've watched this over the years that I've been here at the Capitol. First of all, some years ago, when Senator Pogemiller was chairman of the Senate Education Committee, he basically commissioned a study that took a couple of years. And one of the things that what came out of that study was they were trying to look at what would be the components of a good education for high school students. And I might read some of the things that, as I recall, that were from that study. One was that year-round learning. A second was that it be outcome-based learning. A third, that it provide for youth leadership and development. A fourth, that it provide for parental involvement. Fifth, that there was it maintained assessments to measure outcomes. Sixth was that there be community involvement with the instruction, that it be interdisciplinary study, and that it provide for experiential or work-based learning. Those were some of the things that they felt would be very good in education for all students. If you take a look at the ag education component or the ag education programs, all of those things are integral parts of agricultural education. And it is this three-ringed model that I show you here that makes that work. If you look at historically in Minnesota, starting from the 1950s through the early 1980s, and some of you may even have been in ag programs in high school, and if you look at that time period, what you'd see is that the standards by the Department of Education basically involved year-round education in that area, and they involved 12-ninths contracts for most instructors. Almost all instructors in the state at that time were on year-round contracts, and they worked throughout the summer. And some of the kinds of things that they worked on, of course, were the FFA and the Supervised Ag Experience Program. Now, the Supervised Ag Experience Program is a part where there's hands-on learning. And because of agriculture's seasonal nature, much of that learning in agriculture takes place in the summertime, not just on farms, but in agribusiness as well, and ag industry. And so because it is that period of the year in which these industry service industries to agriculture are operating at their height. So that's one of the things to keep in mind with regard to this. With regard to FFA, certainly there's a leadership component, but one of the things that people don't often think about is that there's the career development component of it as well. One of the ways that we assess or we determine the outcome-based portion of ag ed programs is the fact that once you learn in the classroom, one of the ways that you test yourself is by competing in the FFA, whether it's a soil science class or a food science program or a mechanical program, where one high school, for instance, will compete against another high school in their CDE portion of ag education. And the last thing is community service, that there is a lot of community services involved with ag programs, both as students and as instructors. And so you'll see, for instance, in the summertime, as part of that experiential learning, where many ag instructors do participate with students that, for instance, landscape the local areas, or they provide efforts in the community gardens in areas. Part of the food to schools programs that some of you have supported in the past in this, where ag educators are involved in those kinds of things. I thought I'd give you a quick list, and then I'm going to stop. A quick list of some of the kinds of things that we envision, and it's pretty easy to come up with this list because, in fact, in the past we've had this, but as the recession took place and as there were cuts made over the last number of years in areas, we've lost a lot of this in our ag programs. One of the most common events that takes place in the summertime in almost all counties across the state, as you know, are the county fairs and the state fair projects. And that's one of the areas that FFAers are participatory in throughout the year in terms of the preparation for throughout the summer, and, of course, towards the end of the summer, usually in terms of actually showing in those fairs in different areas and venues. Secondly, they're oftentimes involved in business and industry tours, and this is part of the career exploration portion of grades 9 through 12 that are participatory in that. Leadership, I think, speaks to itself. But along with the leadership in terms of typical FFA experiences comes things like green hand camps that exist in the summertime for freshmen, ed people, and others that are leadership camps. When I was a senior in high school, for instance, I was a district FFA officer and attended the FFA leadership camp at Virginia, a summer project. Beyond that, natural resources projects. Many of you are probably familiar with FFA participating and providing participation in natural resources, whether it's raising pheasants or whether it's being involved in development of wetlands in the summertime. Something I'll just share this with you only because I thought it was so unique. I don't think you'll ever see this ever again. But when I was a member of the FFA in high school, our instructor taught us how to blow wetlands, ponds for ducks by using ammonium nitrate and dynamite. I don't think you'll ever see that ever again in any of these, and I'm not proposing that you should, but I can tell you that at one time when it wasn't considered a hazard and that people weren't concerned about what students would do, that it actually was taught to aid in the wetland development in Waseca County. The other thing I mentioned, for instance, is crop and field days at outreach centers for the university, for instance. And one of the big ones is parental involvement. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that some of the extended programs in particular actually are visiting the farms, the agribusinesses, the place where the students live and work. And they're participating in this involvement with the student and their parents. And I think that is something that if we could do that with every student that was being educated in this state, it would be a great positive for them. The other thing that I point out is that, as I mentioned before, community gardens. One of the new things now that's quite involved is the food to schools. And we do have a number of FFAs that are participatory in that. So the problem is, however, that all of these functions that I talked about, I think most of us would all agree, are good things for us to do. But if you actually look at the number of schools in the state that do this, and they have to do it voluntarily now, where they're paying for the instruction in the summertime, it's less than 30%. And so what this program would do would be to help provide funds in order to make that number expand, and also be fair to those that are already doing it in terms of providing some funds for them as well to improve their programs. So that's really what this bill is about. We don't have a number in it at this point in time. I think the education finance finance area will be the ones that will deal with the actual dollar amounts, but I can tell you that in order to do it across the state for all of the 220 instructors that are likely to participate in it, it would cost approximately $1 million a year. So that, Mr. Chairman, is kind of the report I can give you on this bill.
Thank you. Senator Dames?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I'd just like to thank you for bringing this bill. It's certainly a very good bill, and I think that Mr. Schoenfeldt laid it out very well as the importance of why this is necessary. And it is a little bit different than a lot of things we look at, but it's very important for our students in agriculture and our teachers to have this opportunity. So I'd just like to thank you for bringing the bill and ask that we get behind and support this. Thank you.
Senator Jensen, and I would echo what Senator Dames said. He and myself and Senator Coonan serve on the MEALC board, and we hear about this over and over again. So we're going to get behind you. Obviously, we're going to support it today and wish you good luck in the Education Committee. But Senator Bonhoeff has a comment, too, or a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, thank you for bringing it forward, Senator Jensen. During the interim, I know we've reported at this committee, but we had our advisory council for the dual education bill, and one of them was agriculture. And one of the loudest messages we heard during that advisory council work was that there was a, number one, that kids weren't being exposed to agriculture early enough. Number two, there was how were they going to get to be exposed because there was such a shortage of ag teachers. So anything we can do to shore that up and respond to that is great. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the ag program in Owatonna, which is in my district, used to have four ag teachers in the program, and they're down to one. I know this particular bill won't help that, but at least if we can get some matching money from the district and then from the state to provide this, the ability for that one teacher to work over the summer to provide all the experience that we want for them. The other thing I'll just share real quick is I went to the FFA breakfast and heard from Chatfield Schools, and it reminded me that this involves all kinds of things, science, energy, power, transportation, biotechnology. They're doing some really amazing things in these ag programs that bring in other people that, you know, it's not just corn and cows. It's a whole range of things and opportunities for career and development that we really need to make sure we provide to those students.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further comments, members? If not, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 961 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Jensen.
Thank
Next
you,
up,
Chair.
We have Senator Coonan, Senate File 933. Senator Coonan.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This bill is addressing a problem, and that for beginning farmers, and that is the availability of land in particular, but also production facilities and machinery and livestock. So the goal of the bill is to try and make those things more available to beginning farmers. And this is for beginning farmers who don't have family members to help them get started. So that's where the emphasis of the bill is headed. What it does is expands the Rural Finance Authority's beginning farmer program. Currently, the Beginning Farmer Program at the Rural Finance Authority offers affordable financing, farm management training, and financial planning. What this bill does is authorize tax credits for people who sell or rent agricultural assets to qualified beginning farmers. It also authorizes tax credits for qualified beginning farmers themselves who take an approved financial management course. And the RFA would have the responsibility of determining eligibility of beginning farmers and of owners of ag assets in this program. And the RFA will help beginning farmers get enrolled in financial management programs and link beginning farmers to other helpful organizations so they can be successful as they start their farming career. I have a couple of testifiers with me here today, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Olson and Mr. Sobosinski from the Land Stewardship Project.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Sobosinski. I work with the Land Stewardship Project. And our organization, I work with the policy and organizing program of LSP, and we work on behalf of sustainable agriculture, and by that we mean what sustains the farmer, the community, and the environment. We support more farmers on the land, raising crops and livestock. Besides the state policy program, we also work on federal policy, community-based foods, and a farm beginnings program, and also now a farm transition programs. We have about 3,700 family memberships in our organization. About a third are farmers, and about a third are in rural Minnesota, and about another third are in the metro area. The Land Stewardship Project, we support this bill. We like to look at this bill really as what we call a Beginning Farmers Land Access Act, providing the opportunity to get some more new farmers on the land. As a state, we have not really put forward a piece that has addressed this yet, really to help beginning farmers with the issue of land access. Nebraska, Iowa have programs, and some other states do too. Nebraska calls their act the Next Gen legacy program, getting people involved. I'm pleased to testify today in support of the bill, which is designed to provide tax credits to those who look at selling land to beginning farmers, and also a tax credit to help the beginning farmer with tuition costs of a farm business management program. The whole idea of this program is to look at providing some tools in a toolbox, so to speak, that the beginning farmer can use to reach out to potential land, people who might sell farmland and say, look, as you're looking at your operation and maybe entering a phase where you're going to ratchet down, you know, give some consideration to my interest in farming, just like as once you had a very strong interest in starting farming. So that's the concept behind this bill, and certainly would appreciate the committee supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sobosinski. Mr. Olson, would you like to add some comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nick Olson. I, too, work with the Land Stewardship Project. I work directly with the Farm Beginnings Program. The Farm Beginnings Program is a training program for folks interested in getting into agriculture. We have a 17-year track record, and in that time, we've trained over 650 beginning farmers, many of whom are actively farming today. We currently have 30 families enrolled in our class as of right now, and we meet on a regular basis. I, too, am a beginning farmer. My wife and I own and operate a certified organic vegetable farm in Litchfield, Minnesota. And as a beginning farmer, this issue on land access is one that strikes a chord with me and many of the people that I work with. Access to land is a huge deal. There was a survey done 3 years ago around the entire country that identified access to land as one of the top two barriers for beginning farmers getting started. The other is access to capital. The face of the Minnesota farmer is changing. We have a lot of women getting into farming. We have a lot of people of color getting into farming. And we have a lot of people with non-farm backgrounds, or at least one generation removed from the farm, trying to get started in agriculture. And this access to land piece is the largest barrier for that. As was mentioned before, this bill is not put out to assist farm transitions from one family member to another. There are some good support programs for that already. This is aimed at folks who do not have that access to family land to get onto the land and get started farming. We need more farmers in Minnesota. I don't have that magic age number in front of me, but when I look around my neighborhood, most of the farmers around me have a different color hair than I do, and that's because they've been farming for a long time. And they excitedly stop by my farm often and say how excited they are to see somebody on the land back farming, and they're looking for this. So I think there are a lot of eager established farmers who this bill would resonate greatly with. As a beginning farmer myself, my wife and I looked for 3 years to find a farm. And we were living in Montevideo at the time. We looked all over the district trying to find a farm. We wrote letters to landowners. We spoke at churches. We've hung posters at the post office. We worked with the rural postman to see who was going to die soon so we could contact them and buy their farm, and nothing. It's really hard to find a farm as a beginning farmer. So we looked for 3 years. We extended our search. Just happened to be a for sale by owner on Craigslist. We found a farm for sale south of Litchfield, and we were able to make it happen. I will say there's some great programs for beginning farmers once they identify a farm to actually make a purchase through some of the federal programs, such as Farm Service Agency. But what we saw a few years ago is the cost of land was the largest barrier. And I'm not going to say that the cost of land is not a barrier anymore, because it still is. It's really, really high. However, what we're finding now is there is no land available. So when beginning farmers go to look for farms, if they don't have a dad and uncle in the county, they have to follow traditional means, which is checking with a realtor, looking around. And there are not a lot of farms for sale in our state. In fact, I was on the phone last night with two beginning farmers who want to farm in the Litchfield-Hutchinson area. There is absolutely nothing for sale currently that would meet the needs of a beginning farmer that's within a reasonable price for them to get started. Because of this, a lot of the beginning farmers that I work with through the Farm Beginnings Program are moving to Wisconsin. They're moving to Wisconsin because they're able to find land there, they're able to afford land there, and we are losing a lot of really good potential business owners, rural members of our communities, to Wisconsin right now. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done, but I think this bill could be one of those things that helps entice landowners to work with beginning farmers, and also would open the conversation up to established farmers that there are people such as myself who are interested in getting started farming, and I really think that this bill could help move some of that forward. I want to see more farmers in Minnesota, and I think that that is a thing that we all want. So this bill is good for beginning farmers, and it's also good for the state of Minnesota. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. What did you say, a vegetable farm?
Yeah, we run a certified organic vegetable farm.
Interesting. Grow all kinds of stuff?
You name it except for sweet corn, because I can't compete with that old guy on the back of his truck who sells it for a quarter in a year.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Coonan, I think this is a good bill. I do have a couple of questions on page 2, line 2.5 through 2.11, dealing with blood marriage, this and that. So just a clarification, let's say that we have an individual that's in his mid-40s and that he's farming, say, 240 acres, and he's also working off the farm, and his son wants to start farming. And so the dad's not able to rent his land to the son, but he might be able to let his son use his tractor or something like that if his son would find some land to rent. Would that son qualify then, or would he be disqualified because of the fact that his father farms, even though he's not going to be able to let his son rent or buy his land? Would he be disqualified?
Senator Coonan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, the way I read it, if he wasn't renting from a relative, it would qualify, but maybe we should ask Mr. Knopf.
Okay. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, Senator Coonan, the way I read this is that the beginning farmer cannot be, as soon as they're related by blood or marriage to the owner, they don't qualify as a beginning farmer or producer, livestock producer under this section. So for anything that was not, if the transaction is with somebody who's not a relative by blood or marriage, that can happen. But for a transaction that is related, that cannot happen under this. Is the way I, at least for the tax credit purposes, is so the way I read this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So the fact that he may be using some of his father's machinery would be the transaction you're speaking of?
Well, Mr. Chair, it would be the. This is to get the tax credit. So right. It's whatever. It wouldn't apply for the tax. Being the owner of the machinery wouldn't get a tax credit for allowing them to use it or to renting it.
Right.
But and that's all the purpose for this definition is for the tax credit itself. So if they're not applying for a tax credit for that purpose, then it shouldn't matter.
But how about the young person that's just starting to farm? He would also get a tax credit, right?
The young person starting to farm would get a tax credit.
And would they be eligible under this to do that under that scenario?
Well, it's only for the agricultural assets that are being used for the tax credit itself. I mean, they get two forms of tax credit. One is for the classes, for the training, and they get. But actually, that's the main tax credit the beginning farmer gets. Otherwise, it's the owner of the assets who gets the credit. Yep. And that's the important thing here is that the owner of an asset, if they're related by blood or marriage, would not get a tax credit for it. Now, the one key thing here is, that, and I've mentioned it to Senator Sparks, this is fairly broad as far as not related by blood or marriage. It doesn't talk about degrees of kinship or how far out it can go. I don't. You may want, Mr. Senator Coon, you may want to think about. It just seems like it's, you know, if you go to it's like a fifth degree of kinship, you could get quite a few people in that same township that may be somewhat related either by marriage or by. And so you may want to think about narrowing that down. I was just looking at consanguinity charts, which kind of get you to certain levels, and a lot of times we'll say, you know, within certain degrees of kinship, or we'll spell out to the level of cousin or whatever. You know, this. I'm just saying that this is fairly broad. I don't think you have to do anything with it today, but you may want to think about narrowing it down to make sure that this can work for people out in the country.
Thank you. Senator Dames?
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Knopf, for clarifying that. Looks like a good bill, and if at some point you decide to tighten that up a little bit as far as the blood and the marriage, it might help to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. So thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Coonan and or Mr. Knopf, I'm going to lines page 3, lines 3.10 at the end and through 3.13. My question is, it talks about the payback of credits by the owner of agricultural assets if the lease is if the agreement is terminated with fault. Is death with fault? And the point, reason I'm bringing this up, I can see a situation, for example, whereby the farmer passes away and his widow may not be able to keep the land and it needs to be sold. And if we're making her repay tax credits on the, in addition, we've created, I think, a hardship for a person that really doesn't deserve to have the hardship.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not completely sure what I didn't write this, so I'm not really quite sure what the reason they used the term fault. It says with fault by the owner, so I'm assuming that by the owner of the assets, that's the person who's either selling them or renting
leasing
them to
them,
him,
correct.
Or leasing them to the person. So it's a, because of their fault, then it's terminated because of that. Should not be retroactively disallowed.
And Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, and the fault situation, I think it would be in more of the lease situation whereby the surviving spouse may not be able to continue that lease as a result of the death of the other spouse. And so that could be a necessity.
Senator Coonan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Weber, thanks for bringing that up. That's something we need to think through, I think, on this bill. I'm not going to speak directly to the issue you brought up if there's a death, but I do know that when you look at farm sales, if there's a multiple-year lease, and this is a three-year lease, that lease is still in effect even if farm is sold. So I'm not quite sure how that would play into your scenario, but I think that's something we need to check into.
True. Valid point.
I think Mr. Peterson would like to say a few words on the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we too support this legislation. And it's a priority for us to be bringing farmers back to land. The average age of a farmer in Minnesota is 58 years old. Last numbers I saw, I think it's only 6% of our farmers are 35 years or under. And so, what we can do is, what is our policy in Minnesota for attracting beginning farmers? What's on our menu? We have a lot of good things, like we have the Rural Finance Authority, which Senator Coonan mentioned, the FSA, beginning farmer loans, which the previous minister mentioned. We're doing the livestock grants. We have all these good things, but I think it's also important to put some other things in the toolbox that help us provide incentives for those beginning farmers and people that want to farm. Especially people that don't have a relative. We always talk about people like, or myself, I was able, my parents helped me get started. But a lot of, we see it a lot of through FFA. You see a lot of the kids that are not, don't have a connection, but they would like to start farming on some level. And this program is designed to do that. I looked at the Nebraska program quite a bit and spoke with them about whether it was effective or not in Nebraska. And they have, the director told me in Nebraska that they have quite a few farmers that are farming today that wouldn't have been farming without that credit. And so I think it's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for the witness or the author of the bill? If not, Senator Coonan, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 933 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Coonan.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Sparks, you have Senate File 820 before us, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 820. I do have the A2 delete everything author's amendment that I'd like to offer to get the bill in the shape I would prefer.
All right, members, that should be in your packet. Senator Sparks moves the A2 delete everything author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it to be. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 820 is an effort by the entire ag community, and I think in your package you'll see the multiple organizations that support this, the commodity groups, the Agri-Growth Council, and many farm organizations. With the A2 amendment to the forestry industry, we've addressed an erosion in research and education dollars directed at the backbone of our state economy. I believe it's of great importance that we rebuild our research and technology transfer infrastructure. We have the necessary resources in place for rapid response to address emerging plant and animal diseases and address the issues that have plagued ag education in our state. We saw Senator Jensen's bill earlier, but this bill will try to build even further upon that. And it is these three issues that the bill would address and the reason why it has such strong support from the stakeholders. In the interest of time, members, I'd like to turn it over again to Jerry Schoenfeld to go through the details of the bill, and then we'd be happy to stand for any questions the members may have.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Schoenfeld. If you could restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work for several commodity groups and in agriculture, and I am kind of representing a whole lot of people today, because if you take a look at, I think in your packets you have got this group of sheets, and if you take a look at the front, you'll find that there's been work over the last several months by this coalition of support, and it does include agriculture in its broadest sense. And so with regard to commodity councils and with regard to the forest industries, the Med Association, and others, including Ag Growth Council, I wanted to point out that when we started working on this, to be honest, all of these groups sat around a table, and they took a look at what they wanted to put together for an agenda for agriculture this year. And it started out about 3 pages long and ended up down to 3 points, and it's these 3 points that are covered in this bill. Agricultural research has been a very important engine, economic engine, for both agriculture and the state of Minnesota as a whole. And what I'd like you to do, if you wouldn't mind, is to turn to about the fourth page, in which there is a graph here that shows Minnesota's reliance on food and agriculture. And what points out that Minnesota as a state out of the 50 states is the sixth most reliant state on food and agriculture as part of its GDP. If you take a look at the red line at the top is Minnesota's GDP, portion of the GDP that goes for agriculture compared to the United States average, which is the black line, and then, of course, the top five at the top and the bottom five at the bottom. So it is important for the state in terms of its involvement with regard to getting a good return on investment for agriculture in Minnesota. If you look at the next page, what you'll find is that agricultural receipts in Minnesota are about $21.5 billion. When you add forestry receipts, it's at about $9.7 billion, and the total GDP for the state is $324 billion. So it's about 11% of the total GDP for the state. The next point I'd like you to – next page, I'd like you to take a quick look at the fact that Minnesota is number 6 in terms of gross value of production, but we're number 10th in terms of our research and development spending in the state. And then if you'll take a look at the following page, you'll see that the primary engine for agricultural research expenditures in Minnesota has been driven through the University of Minnesota through our agricultural special, which is in the higher ed bill. And that's very important, and we want to maintain that. This does not compete with those dollars at all. In fact, it is intended not to supplant those dollars, but instead to supplement those dollars and to supplement them for production agriculture. But you'll see that in the year 2001, this state legislature appropriated $58,838,000 in that fund. And last year and this year, because it hasn't changed any, the university did not include any increase in it this year in their request, it stands at $42,922,000. That's a $16 million loss over a 14-year period. And that is what this bill attempts to change. On the following page, you'll see the comparison of the Ag State Special in terms of biennial funding. And you'll see that it's been dropping each year. But more importantly, there are I have taken a look at the university budget in terms of agricultural research and education. And they have about 8 different pots of money that money comes from that is participation in terms of the total funding. Some of those, because CFANS is a educational institution, some of that funding, for instance, about 25% comes from tuition. And all of us know about the tuition increases that have taken place over the last number of years, and that's kind of a separate issue, but part of it comes from there. About 25% comes from the Ag Special. And as you look at others, there's all kinds of other areas that they bring money in. And for instance, I work with the Minnesota soybean growers, and I also work with the Minnesota pork producers. And I can tell you that in the last 8 years, the soybean growers have put about $12.5 million into the university research area, and they've put it into the College of Agriculture in order to hire faculty that would not have otherwise been hired had it not been for the private money that goes in from that particular council. There are 14 commodity councils in Minnesota, most of which also add funds to the University of Minnesota, so that there is a public-private partnership here. And one of the points of this bill is to improve and enhance that private-public partnership as well. And we believe that because the funds would flow through the Department of Agriculture to a specific board that is made up of all the various farm organizations, that it will provide an opportunity for them to be able to involve public funds and private funds from those councils to enhance this even more greatly than it is today. One of the other things, if you take a look at the one page here on Minnesota Ag Experiment Station spending, what you'll see is that in the first series of bars, that from the 1970s to the 1980s, that the state of Minnesota increased on a per-year basis approximately 4% per year in terms of agricultural research spending. However, if you look at the 1990s, you'll see that those funds were lowered and leveled down to a point of losing about, and I'm talking about the state portion here, losing about 1% a year. And from the 2000s, from year 2000 until 2014, the amount of state funding was 4% a year less. And so we'd like to reverse that trend, and that's what this bill is all about. There are 3 portions to this bill. The first one does deal with $30 million that would be supportive of the agricultural research effort. The second one is to enhance the Agricultural Rapid Response Fund. Those monies are presently at about $2 million. And every year we seem to have a new disease that hits agriculture. And it hits all of agriculture, organic, inorganic, everybody. As an example, last year, PED, some of you may have heard of that. There was some funding that came through this committee 2 years ago for that. PED was a hog disease that was killing about 20% of the baby pigs in our hog facilities. And so we put money into rapid response to try and alleviate the devastation of that disease. Before that, bovine tuberculosis was very big 1 year. We've seen things like wheat rust. We've seen things like white mold in soybeans and so forth. These diseases are very devastating, and they change things within the state. For instance, up in Senator Eakin's area and north of Senator Coonan's area, you'll find that I'm from southern Minnesota, and we were always big in soybeans. But now the number 1 and 2 soybean counties in the state are, I believe, Marshall and Polk, which are up in northwestern Minnesota. They were driven there by soybean disease that took place in southern Minnesota. And they were, in a sense, deposited there because of wheat rust that drove the wheat out of that part of the state. And so this disease thing is something that's very important, and that's why we have funds in for that. In addition to that, ag education is kind of one part of that stool in terms of providing money for farm business management, for instance, and in addition to that, funds for high schools and so forth. And primarily the funds we're looking at here would probably be earmarked, in a sense, for farm business management. And I know that Senator Eakin has got a bill on that will probably put a little more detail, a little more flesh on the bone as such. But that's primarily what we're taking a look at there, is trying to do something with the Farm Business Management funds in the state as well. We're about $2.7 million shortfall in that area. And that's through MNSCU. So the point I bring that up is because these funds are not available only for the University of Minnesota, but for MNSCU and that kind of an area as well. So, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of my review of what the bill is about and what was behind it and what drives it. The other thing I'd point out for those of you that are not all, and some of you are not from heavy agricultural areas, but I'd point out one other thing. Recent studies that we've taken a look at from the United Nations show that within 35 years that we're going to have to more than double our food supply in the world. And where most of that comes from is research. And we've had approximately an 11% return on agricultural research, according to the university and the numbers that they take a look in terms of the economic return to the state and to agricultural research. So I think it's a good investment and one that I think is overdue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Any questions, discussion at this stage? You know, Senator Sparks, Mr. Schoenfeld, if you could just comment, to what extent, how does this supplement or compete with the Agricultural Utilization Research Board right now that we have in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, it has nothing to do with the Agricultural Research Utilization Research Board. The Agricultural Utilization Research Institute was designed to deal with applied research and market and development of products within the marketplace. And these researches, the kind of research that we're talking about here is production research, and it really has nothing to do with it.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any questions, comments? Well, Senator Sparks, would you like to move the bill?
If there's no further questions, I certainly would, Mr. Chair. I would move that Senate File 820 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
All right. Any further discussion?
Question.
Yeah. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, so explain why it goes to state and local, and then, oh, because of the councils and the board makeup, and then it would go back to finance. Is that where it would go?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, yeah, because we're creating a new transfer board, it has to go to state and local, I understand, and then it will go to Finance Committee, Senator Tomasoni's committee.
Gotcha.
And I'm glad you were here to hear the discussion on higher education as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Senator Sparks, and I did meet with Mr. Schoenfeld and you know, at first was pretty surprised by the large price tag, but had a good conversation and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, Senator Sparks moves Senate File 820 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Governments. Without further discussion, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right, folks, that completes our business for the day. The meeting is adjourned.